welcome y'all to the Drug Examination Podcast. Yes, I'm doing the opening and not Amber or Joseph. So that means we're down two of the podcasters. Unfortunately, duty calls, they both have work assignments to be done and won't be able to be graced with their presence this episode. However, we have a guest host. Could you please introduce yourself to our audience?
I can. My name is Jamie Rutkowski. I currently work for the two best humans on earth, Teeley McVeigh and John Castle at Castle McVeigh Law Firm, doing personal injury plaintiffs work. And I used to work for Judge Cooper and Judge Toll. And now we're with another fabulous judge.
Yes. So we're pleasure to have you here. Thank you for filling in. So it's not just me and everybody would tune out and turn off so we can actually get some downloads. So our esteemed guest should be able to carry us for the day. It is the one and only, the Honorable Robert Hood of the 5th Judicial Circuit. He graduated from the Citadel and the University of South Carolina School of Law before beginning his career in front of the bench as a solicitor in the 5th Judicial Circuit. Then he went to the Assistant Attorney General's office in the State Grand Jury Division, prosecuting those cases. And then after a career in private practice, he was elected to the bench by the General Assembly in 2012, where he serves now as the resident judge for the 5th Judicial Circuit, which encompasses Richland and Kershaw counties. It's an absolute pleasure and honor to have you on the show, Judge Hood.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a great honor to be here. I enjoy the podcast, and I love listening to podcasts in general, so I'm super excited about being here this evening. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, you know, just having members of the judiciary on the show is a really big deal for us. You know, we've had obviously, several at this point. We've had a justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court, Justice Few. We're very lucky enough and actually honored to have him on. And now we can say we have a member of the Circuit Court. Hopefully, here in the new future with scheduling, we'll have former Chief Justice Plekonis, which will be great. And so we're just glad to have that perspective from the Circuit Court. And so, again, thank you. Kind of the first question I have is that transition from private practice. You know, you'd set your career up as a prosecutor, then into private practice, kind of a natural progression for many people is to serve some years as a prosecutor and then go into private practice. And having a thriving private practice, what made you feel like you wanted to serve on the judiciary?
Well, I just kind of reached a point where I was at the majority of my children's sporting events on the phone with my clients who had all paid us very well, who thought that, you know, they had basically unlimited access to you 24 hours a day.
I feel your pain.
And you know that and know that stretch of life. You know, I found myself on vacations in the summer and in the spring, answering email and calling people back while my children were playing on the beach. So that's kind of one reason I looked into becoming a judge. And then the second reason is I think we as citizens of this great state that we all love so much have a duty and responsibility to give back to the state and to provide service to the state. And that's something that has always been something I wanted to do. And it was finding the right avenue to do it. And it worked out well for where I was in private practice about 8 years into private practice. So, you know, I first ran for judge when I was 34 years old. I made it out of screening the first time ever. That was 2010. I was 34. And that Judge Benjamin won that race. So I was in that race with Judge Benjamin and a career prosecutor named John Metters. And when I got told to get out, I got out like I was supposed to. And then the next year, literally, you know, 5 or 6 months later, Judge Cooper, who Jamie worked for, his seat opened up. And I ran for that seat and made it out of screening and won that seat in a race that actually went to the board. So we actually had a live vote, which is a new level of stress as you're counting ticks and you know, ticking off who voted for you and who didn't and making all the count. But, you know, so I was elected in 2012. I didn't start. I wasn't allowed to start until January 1st of 2013 due to Judge Cooper's retirement. And it's been just a great 7-8 years now.
Wild ride.
Yeah, it really has been. I have seen more, and I've held court in 28 or 29 of the 46 counties already.
Wow.
So it's been a wild ride, and I love it. It's a great job. There's not a day where I don't wake up and am not excited to go be a judge or to hold court in some county somewhere in the state.
Where were you in private practice at?
So I practiced for Pete with Pete Strom at the Strom Law Firm. So I started off as an assistant solicitor in Richland County. I have been the law clerk at the Fifth Circuit Solicitor's Office to Johnny Gasser, Knox McMahon, David Pasco, and Lud Campbell.
Those are some name drops.
So by the time I graduated law school, I had sat through 3 to 4 full-blown murder trials, at least 2 death penalty trials. One of my 403s was a 3-week long child abuse, homicide by child abuse case where Dateline NBC was there, all as a law clerk. And so at the same day I was sworn in on November of 2001, I did a guilty plea that afternoon in front of Judge Barber where he yelled at me.
Welcome to the practice. Right.
And then within 2 months, I tried a murder case with 2 defendants. That was the first murder on a college campus in over 30 years in South Carolina history. And both of the defense attorneys had been practicing law longer than I had been alive. So
how'd it go?
It was great. It was great. No, it was a sad case, but one of the things we talked about is war stories. And so I had the first witness, and I'll never forget his name. First witness in my whole life. This is January of 2002 in a murder trial, TV cameras in the courtroom. And Johnny Gasser had given the opening statement for the state, and the defense had brought up all these, this kind of the defense of, it was outside on a college campus at night, and that the lighting was so bad, like the street lights, that all these witnesses that we had really couldn't see what they say they saw. Well, that had never crossed our minds. Literally, it was not an issue, right? So I put up witness number 1, and he's the responding officer. His name was Torres Sanders. And witness number 2 was the crime scene person who processed the crime scene. And it was a female, but I don't remember her name. And literally, as I was getting up from my chair in trial, Johnny Gasser tugs me on the arm, and I lean down. Jury's in the room, and he says, "You need to get this witness qualified as an expert in the area of crime scene lighting." Oh. Okay. Now, literally, this is the second witness of my entire life. And if you don't think I had every single question written out,
you weren't well versed in qualifying an expert witness.
And I kind of looked at him, and we looked at each other, and of course, I had, gone over this woman's questions with her, 10 times because I was so nervous. And so I started asking her all these questions, and she started looking at me like,
What have you done?
Where's this coming from?
Exactly. And so I started asking her about all of her qualifications on crime scene lighting. Of course, I don't know the answer to any of these questions.
Just hoping what she's saying is.
So I said, "Well, have you ever been qualified as an expert in the area of crime scene lighting before?" And she said, "Nope." And Henry McKellar was the circuit court judge who's now retired. And he looked at the defense attorneys and he looked at me and started shaking his head in the negative. And I said, "Judge, there's a first time for everything." And so that was my introduction to the practice of law. Then I went to the state grand jury. When I went to the state grand jury, I was brought in as a drug prosecutor. So, sled agents, I had my own team of sled agents that were assigned to me, and we did multi-county drug trafficking cases. I mean, it was a really cool job. We traveled the whole state in sled cars, and I mean, you had a sled agent that drove you everywhere you went, and we tried some really big drug cases against some really great lawyers, but, my boss at the time at the state grand jury and the person who hired me at the state grand jury was Sherry Lydon, who, as you all know, has just been appointed to be a United States District Court judge. And that is great. Because,
well deserved.
Yeah.
I just got assigned a case to her. So
Sherry Lydon is one of the greatest human beings on the face of the earth. And if anybody deserves a federal judgeship and is eminently qualified for it, it is her. But she was my boss at the state grand jury, And so she left the state grand jury. And then at that point in time, literally out of the blue over the Christmas holidays, Pete Strom called me and said, "Hey, you want to come work for me?" And I'll never forget, we had lunch at Mr. Friendly's, and I said, "Pete, I just don't know if I can do this." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I've been prosecuting all these people for all these years, and I don't know if I can be a criminal defense attorney." And he said, and I quote, "Everybody's got a mama." Meaning everybody has some redeeming qualities, you know, and that's certainly been true. And Pete and I traveled the entire state, and for that matter, the entire country, doing criminal defense and civil litigation. And we had some of the most amazing times of my life. Working for Pete was a true pleasure and was a great honor. And we really, we represented some very notorious and
innocent people,
large scale,
alleged.
Yeah. And it was a lot of fun. But we had a really good time. And being a criminal defense attorney was a great experience. And I think it just.
And the most fun.
It really is the most fun. And I think it really helped me prepare for being a judge, being able to see both sides of the story, both sides of the equation, to be able to see the impact that sentences have on families and family units outside of just what we see in the courtroom. So I wouldn't trade that experience for anything in the world, in how much it aids me in being a judge on a day in and day out basis.
Well, we have a lot or significant amount of people who listen to this podcast are either law students or young lawyers. And so when you talked about that kind of trial by fire, that crucible of here's my first day and I'm already doing a guilty plea, within a few months I'm trying a murder case. My advice to young lawyers have always been that if they truly want to be a trial lawyer or wanted to be a judge in their future, how important it is to be either a solicitor or a public defender early on in their career, because you're just not going to have anything close to that type of experience in your career. I mean, as a bench, you're in front of public defenders and solicitors all day.
And if you look at the history of people that are who we all think is kind of the criminal law titans in this state, you know, most of them are either career prosecutors or were long-term prosecutors that became criminal defense attorneys. Now, the one exception to that rule is Mr. Swirling, you know, who was a criminal defense attorney on day number one.
Right.
And if you talk, you know, and Jack and I, we've known each other, you know, since I started the solicitor's office as a law clerk in 1999. So what's that, over 20 years now. And he will tell you, and he tells young lawyers all the time, if you really want to be a great criminal defense attorney, you need to go to magistrate court and try every single case you can.
Get in the batting cage.
And that's the way you learn. And that's the way you learn how to cross-examine people and how to get along with police officers and how to deal with judges' rulings and everything else. And, you know, I have tried cases against Swirling when I was a prosecutor. We tried a large scale methamphetamine dealer by the name of Meemaw, and she was a grandmother, and she is a reported opinion statement.
Are you birth certificate name? Meemaw?
Are you telling me that you sent Big Mama, Big Meemaw to the big house?
Meemaw got 30 years in prison, and so that was the case against Swirling. And then when I was in private practice, we represented people together, so co-defendants or somebody would hire both of us. And then, of course, Swirling has appeared in front of me and tried multiple cases in front of me as a judge. So I've kind of run the gamut with him. But
Well, I've always told Delgado, who's my mentor, that, you know, it feels good to be a pure blood defense attorney, not one of these turncoats.
Right. I'm with you.
I got to throw some zingers
out. No. I'm with you.
No. So one of the things I've always also thought of is the amount of travel you do as a circuit court judge is pretty significant. And that's something in the back of my mind. I've always said, man.
So it's kind of hit or miss. We have virtually no control over it. Back when Chief Justice Finney was the Chief Justice, you traveled for 6 months. So you were on the road for 6 months and then you were home for 6 months. If you actually read the history of the South Carolina court system That's the way they had it. So many months at home, so many months away. And a lot of those months, and it was dependent upon the weather. You know, they didn't hold court in July and August because it was so hot.
There was no air conditioning, right?
And there was no air conditioning. These days, you know, depending on who the judge is, most judges are traveling about 1, maybe 2 weeks a month, unless they're a chief administrative judge somewhere. And I personally love the travel. I think it is so much fun. It is so much fun to go to new courthouses and meet new people and see new lawyers. You know, when I go hold court in Spartanburg, which I did last year for the first time, I didn't know any of those lawyers. So you don't have any relationship with them. You don't know them. You never really handle cases with them. They were all new to me. So everybody's got a clean slate. And
it's exciting.
There's no history. There's no, you know, I remember when you did this or when you said that. I've done a lot of court in Horry County, and I love going down to Horry County. They treat me well, and they always have a lot of work to do. And it's, I think it's just fun to travel the state.
And kind of to add to that, so have you seen, and I've noticed it from the defense attorney standpoint, each kind of county or circuit has their own flavor with the lawyers and the styles. It's so different, you know, different styles and cultures.
100%. 100%. Yeah, the way, you know, the relationships, the way they get along with each other, the way they treat each other is different and unique from county to county.
So as far as guilty pleas are concerned, we won't hammer you with all the criminal stuff. I'll pass it to Jamie here in a second. I've always found it incredibly difficult for a judge, if I was put in your position, if I was had to be, wear the robe of making a snapshot decision about a young man or woman's life in the, you know, 5 to 25 minutes in most guilty pleas, because most are around anywhere between 5-10 to 25 minutes long, and just having that snapshot of the case, and really the defense attorney and the prosecutors know the case better than anybody, and you're hearing this quick summary and having to make a snap judgment on an issue that could possibly change that person's life. I've always been in awe. And having that responsibility, that is that same type of awe of the responsibility of a jury having to render a verdict, because you have such little information truly about that person, who they are in their life. If the defense attorney doesn't do their job, you have even less. And so, is that just something that weighs on you?
You know, and I figured when I went on the bench that was going to be the easiest thing for me to do. And that's the hardest. And anybody that tells you any differently either isn't doing enough or just doesn't have a heart. So one of the judges that I begged to be able to train with was Judge Cooper, not Jamie's Judge Cooper, but Judge Cooper from Manning. And in my opinion, he's the finest circuit court judge alive. If I could speak like he speaks, you know, my world would be so much better. And that's Judge Thomas Stubby Cooper from Manning. And I sat with Judge Manning for a week in Aiken, and I sat in awe of him the whole week. But one of the things that he gave me as we finished up the week were kind of his rules for being a judge. And I keep that in my criminal notebook and in my civil notebook. I don't hold court without those rules somewhere close. And they're very dear to me. And some of them are simple, like how to pick an alternate juror in the middle of a trial, right? Those rules you can never, who knows that off the top of their head?
No, you got to pull that from
exactly. The back. Right. Some of them are that simple, but the last thing in that little sheet of paper, 2 or 3 sheets of paper that he gives judges is sentencing. And it says, sentencing is the hardest thing you will ever do. You will sentence harder in the beginning than you do later on in life. But you don't ever lose sight that you are truly impacting people's lives. And, you know, you need to give them the due consideration that they are owed. And that really, it does weigh on you. Now, in that serious vein, but 90% of the sentencings that I do are what I call no-brainers. Like, everybody knows.
You're not being torn in half.
Right. You know, decision. This guy's getting time served, or this guy's getting probation, or this, you know, this woman's getting a fine. You know, those kind of what I call no-brainers, right? Or if it's negotiated, you know, sure. And a lot of times pleas are negotiated. It's the 10% that are hard, that are really hard, that weigh on you, that
you really can't describe to a person who's never had to make that decision. Right.
What advice would you give to like a new attorney coming in of what information they can provide to you to help you make those difficult decisions?
Well, you know, in federal court, when somebody gets a sentencing, the federal judge gets a 25-page memorandum of about every single thing they've ever done, their entire life history, their entire financial history, their entire schooling and every single thing else. And they have all this time and a U.S. probation officer to sit down and explain it all to them and three law clerks.
Right. They know everything about the person.
Right. They know everything basically there is to know about the person. 90% of the guilty pleas that I do last under 5 minutes, and I'm making a split second decision on, you know, what to do or what not to do or how to deal with the situation. So, you know, with anything else, it's about preparation. You know, you can tell the people that come in front of you, the lawyers that come in front of you that are really prepared and have really spent their time with their client and the ones that haven't. And it's just obvious on the record and it's obvious in the courtroom. So if you're, you know, if you fall into that 10%, then, you know, it's go time and you need to have all your ducks in a row, all your people there. You need to have your client prepared for, you know, what questions I ask the same questions almost all the time. So right. they're not that complicated. So, you know, but you got to spend the time preparing for it. And, you know, I used to tell people when I represented people and we would do a guilty plea, and I know we're recording, so you can't see this, but I would hold my hands really close together, you know, like about 2 inches apart. And I would say, if you decide to talk to the judge at the end of the plea, you can help yourself this much. But I'm going to spread my hands out, you know, to the full 6 feet and say, if you decide to speak to the judge, you can hurt yourself this much.
Right.
So let's talk about what you're really going to say to this judge. You're going to say,
and let's keep it within those 2 inches.
And you're going to be calling them Your Honor.
I'm sorry. My mama didn't raise me this way. I want to apologize to the victims if there are victims. I want to apologize to my parents for putting them in this situation. And, you know, I want to be a better person, you know.
Really, outside of that, there's not a whole lot.
Right. I've heard some brutal conversations during the pleas where I'm like, oh, that's not helping you at all.
So, you know, that's my advice to the attorneys in the pleas.
Well, I think it's a great segue with you talking about preparation. One of our questions is, what are the traits of effective trial attorneys that you've seen in your courtroom? And preparation is obviously key, one of the major components.
So I think one of the things that was, I don't know that it was lost on me before I went on the bench, but it's much more in my face now, is that the variety of things that I hear in the matter of 30 days is overwhelming. And there's no way for anyone to know it all. So this morning, this was my morning, I had a commercial landlord-tenant hearing.
I'm sorry.
I had a residential landlord-tenant hearing. I had a multi-million-dollar products liability case that involves trade secrets.
Always. Okay. Right. They never want to hand those over.
I had a car wreck case, your average car wreck case. I had a case where the insurance carrier was suing the injured party because they believe they're not responsible for paying for their damages. I mean, all this was one afternoon in one morning, right? And that's on top of the how many ever guilty pleas and motions that I did last week. And last year, I tried a death penalty case in Horry County that I've been working on for about 3 years. So in the month of, between the months of April and May, I did everything from a municipal court hearing appeal to a magistrate court appeal to a probate court appeal to a wreck case to a medical malpractice case to 100 plus guilty pleas and motions and a death penalty trial. All in, you know, the average Joe Blow wreck case, all in 60 days. And I'm expected to know and understand the law on all that. So I say to the, you know, I say to attorneys, you know, you all throw out these statutes and rattle off these statutes because you spend your days looking at them. You know, so when you're going 1,000,000 miles per hour in that motions hearing, I promise you, I'm trying to follow along.
Catch me up.
I'm trying to read, but slow down a little bit and make it more of a teaching moment. I remember when we tried all the Home Gold and Carolina Investors cases, Sherry Lydon and I and Judge Johnson were making law. There were no criminal securities fraud cases that existed in South Carolina. So as I was walking Judge Johnson through all the securities fraud laws from all over the country, it was like I was teaching a class trying to explain this is why the standard needs to be this. And so when you get into that motions practice, I know what the summary judgment standard is. I don't need, or the, the 12B6 standard, but when you get into the nuts and bolts of why, you know, this doesn't fit into this UIM that
the arguable issue.
Yeah, you know, slow down. And, you know, if you want to talk about a statute, hand me a copy of it. Or you want to talk about a case, hand me a copy of that so I can read it and look at it instead of an hour later, we're back in the office trying to figure out what was that Bridgestone case?
You know, with civil case, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, how many motions you have in 1 week and how many.
Like 150.
Right. And you get paperwork. One. I mean, I heard you say you got a 140 page motion, you know, some are 2 pages. What is the most effective way? Obviously, some you have time to breeze through, sometimes you don't. What is the most effective way for a civil attorney to get their point across in motions
hearings? So one of the issues with civil motions hearings is so many of them fall off.
That's true.
Okay,
so motion compels.
Right. So, I mean, we'll get a docket that'll have for a week in a major county. Now, this isn't true in Kershaw, right? There's 5, right? Or 7,
sweet
right?
Kershaw.
Right. But, when you're in Greenville, Charleston, Horry, Columbia, you know, you'll get a docket that has 150 to 200 cases on it for 1 week, right? Well, it's impossible to read all of that.
Right. That's not happening.
It's impossible. And 9 times out of 10, the attorneys haven't filed anything other than the basic motion. They file the memo the night before or the morning of.
And bring it up to the bench.
Bring it up to the bench and hand it to the opposing counsel.
This?
Right. So there's really no way I can read it then.
Right.
Right. So, you know, we spend our time going through that docket and trying to figure out these are things that need to be read and these are things that don't. Because in the beginning, when I went on the bench, the law clerks were dying because they were reading every single thing. And then, you know, 30 or 40 hearings would fall off and, you know, they would have spent all this time briefing all this stuff and nothing happened with it. So I try to go through the dockets and say, this is the complex issue, or see that, you know, they asked for all this time for this hearing. We need to stop and read that.
Okay.
And the best thing to do, if you really want the judge to read it, is to send the judge a copy of it. Because with electronic filing, you know, I get a thumb drive.
Yeah.
That has every single, all 150 files on it in no order. So it's just like from page 1 of file 1 to the last page of file 150.
And you get it Monday morning, right?
I usually get it Monday morning or the Friday before.
Okay.
Maybe. Right. And so the idea that, you know, I'm going to find your stuff is...
But you're going to go on a goose chase.
Right. I mean, it's possible, but it's not easy. It's not easily searchable.
So if
it's something you want me to read, no, I want you to send me a copy of it.
Just go ahead.
And probably a week before, Friday afternoon.
The further in advance you can get it to me, the more, you know, like I have a hearing that's set for tomorrow that's a case that's assigned to me, you know, and they got me all that stuff a week ago, 2 weeks ago. And so I have time to process through it, to think about it. So the law clerk and I can talk about it. And I have it all sitting right there in front of me, and we can have a more intelligent conversation about it because I feel like I'm up to speed on it. I mean, the majority of the hearings, you know, that I will do this week, the people will hand me their memos when we start the hearing. So, you know, I can read it on the back end, but, you know, I'd like to be more prepared, but it's just part of the.
And it helps you ask questions, probably.
Right.
Too,
it helps me understand the issues more when I have time to prepare.
And you definitely would prefer the paper copy sent versus the email.
Yeah.
That's got everything attached.
That's right.
Because then you're just having to make your law clerk print everything.
Yeah. Well, you're having to print everything, and it's, you know, where's the paper? And then think about printing everything when you're in Horry County. So I get put in, and I'm not picking on Horry County. I love Horry County. It's one of my.
It's anywhere though.
It's one of my favorite places.
You're a visiting judge. You show
but
up.
Man. You're in a visiting judge. You're in a visiting judge's chamber. You have no administrative assistant, and there's no printer in the room.
It's a problem.
So,
good luck.
So if you email me all that stuff Sunday night before the Monday morning hearing, you know, I can pull it up on my computer while we're in the hearing. But, you know, the idea that I'm printing it out and highlighting it and going through that is an impossibility in most situations. And I've almost stopped taking my computer on the bench, you know, and I do that because I want the attorneys to understand I'm paying attention to what you're saying. I'm hearing what you're saying. I often repeat back to the attorneys what I hear them saying to make sure I'm tracking. This is where you are, like in my commercial landlord tenant dispute this morning.
Enthralling.
Right. They were 5 minutes into it, and I was like, "Time out. Who's the landlord, and who's the tenant?"
Let's take a step back.
They all have these, you know, unusual corporation names. So I'm like,
"Hold on.
Which one's which?" You know. So I say that not to be frustrating, but I say that you know to make sure I'm tracking what you're saying. So.
So for our future listeners who would like to try to be your law clerk, what best advice would you have for somebody who's not just eyeing a position necessarily to be your law clerk, but a circuit court law clerk in general?
So one of my favorite judges is Judge Cothran from Manning. And I'm not going to try to impersonate him, even though I think I do a fairly good impersonation of him. But Judge Cothran said to me, "You can have the smartest law clerk in the world, but if you don't get along with him or her, your year's going to be miserable." Right.
And constantly right. together.
And that's a big thing.
That's your
so
rule.
You're really spending 8 hours or more a day together. I mean, if I'm going to Horry County to do a hearing and, you know, we're not spending the night, then we're going to spend 4.5 hours in the car together.
On top of the workday.
And you got to like this person.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, I say to potential law clerks, you know, I want you to make good grades. Every time I've ever hired law clerks, I've had somebody that's in the top or multiple people that are in the top 10, not 10%, but top 10 of their class apply to work for me. And I've never hired any of those people.
Look, us bottom feeders need jobs today.
So
that's that compassion we're talking about.
I tell people I want to see that you make good grades, that your grades have steadily improved over being in law school, kind of once you figured out that we're not an undergrad, there's not an exact answer, you know, and you figure that part out. But personality is just so much. And I want people that have a wide variety of experience.
An interest, probably.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I have a lot of people that apply that have never clerked anywhere but a solicitor's office. I don't even interview those people because you bring nothing to the table for me.
Only one perspective.
That's right. You bring one perspective and nothing else. And so I like people that have worked at different places, small firms, big firms, split their time between firms in the summer. You know, if you say you work at a firm and I know that firm, I say, well, you know, who'd you work for there? And what'd you think of that? And what'd you get to work on? Because I want to know you have a personality and you know, if we have to spend 2.5 hours in the car together, you know,
you're not going to want to jump out of the car.
That's exactly right. So, but you know, you're making a decision that impacts a year of your life in a 10 minute interview. So, you know, it's hit or miss, but I've had wonderful law clerks, all of which I think the world of, and who have all become, you know, very successful attorneys in their own right. So
for people, again, this talking to the same group of people who want to be law clerks, do you use your law clerks not just for prep and research, but ask them their specific opinions in the middle of a trial on?
Oh yeah,
you know, because I'm sure a lot of people, all the judges do it differently, but. Do you lean on them heavily sometimes just to get that extra opinion from a different?
I tell my law clerks on day number one, I say, these are the unwritten law clerk rules. Okay. And I have a whole list of them. Right. But, you know, one of those is I can hire anybody to say, yes, judge, you're right. Right.
Yeah. If you want a yes, man, that's
you don't need a law degree to say, yes, sir, your honor, or you're right. You need a law degree and you need your own independent thinking to say, this is why I don't think you're heading down the right track, or this is why I think this is the better answer. Or, and here's my argument why, and how, you know, and of course they're all scared the first day,
sure,
you know, and until you learn the personality of your judge, you know, because we all have our own personalities. But I want somebody that we can sit down and have a full blown discussion with, or, you know, you want to write a memo about it and we talk about it and read it, or you say, I think you're wrong and this is why. And it's, you know, there's a certain camaraderie that develops, but
it makes you a better judge.
That's right. It makes me a better judge, gives me another perspective. And I have an extern this semester, which I usually have an extern from the law school every semester. And I gave her a project today, and this was her first week. And I said, now, I don't need you to spend 4 hours on this. I need you to spend 30 minutes on this. But next week, I want us to be able to have a conversation about it. And right. I just don't want you to say, yeah, you're right. I want you to make your argument for me and tell me why you think it's right and what your basis for it is. So I look for that too. But every judge,
I think a lot of judges look at, because I remember with Judge Toll, we were trying it like a 2-week asbestos case with attorneys from all over the country. I thought something was hearsay and I disagreed with her, and she let me know very in front of everyone how much she disagreed with what I said. But you have to stand your ground, make your argument. And at the end of the day, both my judges, at least, really appreciated, 100%. Regardless of what my opinion was, if I had a good argument, and, you know.
Yeah, and I think it makes you a better lawyer.
Absolutely.
When you come out. So, you know, I value that. I truly enjoy having a law clerk. I think it's one of the great assets to the judiciary in this state. And so I think they're great. And I tell people all the time, I have a in of court mentees, and, you know, both of them are clerking for judges next year. One on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and one in Florence. And, you know, we had lunch today and talked about, you know, they had a lot of questions.
Yes, I'm sure.
What is this going to look like? And so we talked through that, but I think it's a great experience. I did not clerk for a judge, and that's one of my regrets that I have in my legal career, but I had Johnny Gasser dangling, you know, you're going to be trying a case within 60 days of getting sworn in. And
it's a
so it was hard to say, I'm going to go.
Well, not everyone has that experience.
Judge. Right. So
with, again, not just focused on young lawyers, but all lawyers and law students who are listening and just people in general, what are the pitfalls that lawyers should avoid, or pro se litigants, when they appear in your court? And what have you seen, not just mistakes that young lawyers make, but just what are the big mistakes that you would say, if I could reach out to all the lawyers and say, stop making this type of mistake, or mistakes in general, what's the, you know, not pet peeves, but just basic mistakes that happen too often?
I remember when I went into private practice and was about a year into it, one of my friends who I had worked at the solicitor's office with, his name was Eddie Donald. He's now the new circuit public defender for the Third Circuit. Eddie had been in private practice about a year more than I had. And we were somewhere waiting on a hearing, you know, somewhere, you know what that's like, sitting around waiting on a hearing.
I've those comfortable right. pews, I was going to say.
Waiting on the judge, you know. And I said, you know, I was talking to Eddie about all the, you know, the struggles of being in private practice and getting people to pay you and all that kind of stuff. And then I was like, you know, I feel like, I mean, when I was in private practice, I would start the morning at the City of Columbia, you know, for criminal court. I would leave there and go to circuit court. I would leave there and go to a federal sentencing and federal court. And I would leave there and go to the town of Irmo or the town of Chapin for night court.
For night court.
Right. And I mean, that was a Tuesday. Right. Right.
And then there's 50 phone calls.
To right. And there's phone calls and people expect you to email them back and all that kind of stuff. And Eddie looked at me and said, you know, this is the art of never being fully prepared for anything.
Right.
Right. And I really felt like that a lot.
Putting out one fire after the
That's
next.
Right. And so, you know, the pitfalls I see with people is it's just a, you know, I don't know if it's a time or it's a time management, but it's just a lack of being
fully prepared.
Fully prepared. I mean, that's the biggest frustration that you have is, you know, like, this is a big case. You know, this is a major issue, and you haven't gone and pulled one case on this issue. Right.
And that's got to be incredibly frustrating.
It is. It's easy to forget how hard it is to be a lawyer, right? And it's easy to forget that you weren't, when I say you, I mean me,
sure,
weren't perfect as a lawyer either. And then it's easy to sit there and say, well, if I was trying this case, I would have you know,
armchair quarterback,
done these 10 things to be fully prepared.
We all fall short of the glory, right?
That's right. And me, number one. And so it's processing through that is hard as a judge to, you know, remember that, you know, back to the Judge Cooper rules, you know, rule number one is don't ever forget you were a lawyer too. And don't ever forget what it was like to be a lawyer. And so I'm constantly reminding myself of that, that, you know, you have 300 emails in your inbox and your goal today is just to get it under 100.
To survive.
Right. I mean, to really, and to be diligent with your clients.
And get yelled at every once in a while.
You know, and so, you know, that the other thing that I think, you know, with lawyers and, you know, 2020 is they just need a little bit thicker skin. Too. I mean, I grew up in the days of, you know, Jack Early and, you know, this guy from down in Bamberg with the last name of Peoples in Barnwell.
I've only heard the stories of right. Judge Peoples, but I've been in front of Judge Early. And
right. And you know, and those lawyers had thick skin.
And you had to.
And, you know, these days, just because I rule against you doesn't mean I don't like you or I didn't like your argument, or I think you're a bad lawyer, but, you know, somebody's got to win and somebody's got to lose. So
there was some CLE that I was speaking at, and I just said, if you wanted to be a criminal defense attorney and a good, effective one, you can't be somebody that wants to hear the word yes a lot. You will be ruled.
So
you,
true.
The word no will be told to you 90-something% of the time, and you have to just use that as the stepping stone to the next no half the time. That just has to be part of it. The underdog mentality of not being able to take yes well is that's just not something that.
Yeah, I mean, not the nature of business. On the appointment list in Orangeburg County my entire time I was in private practice, and Jimmy Williams was the resident judge. I mean, there may as well have been four prosecutors in the room with him on the bench. Now, I love Jimmy Williams to death, and he was a great judge. But I mean, he ruled against me every time I opened my mouth. I mean, it was, you know, and that was just part of it. That didn't mean I wasn't prepared, or I hadn't done my job, or I hadn't created the record. That's just kind of the way it is.
Sometimes us need to cry, okay? Us millennials.
So I did not write this on the sheet, but I am for it 100%. Can we please have voir dire?
That was my question.
Attorney conductive voir dire?
Yes.
I did not.
15 minutes. That's all we ask.
I meant like real voir dire. So yes, attorney conductive voir dire. That's a tough sell, I know, but it's something I've pushed tremendously. And I'm so glad that you wrote that, because I filed that motion every time. And I've only had some traction here or there, but generally it's the side-eyed look of it's not happening unless the General Assembly says it can happen.
Well, I mean, I think that's the real answer. But the short answer for me in the meantime is I try to be very liberal with what the attorneys want me to ask. And I try to err on the side of, you know, asking more questions than asking less. And actually, when I get into a trial and no one asked me for any questions, I kind of have an internal panic attack. Right. Like, right. You know, we're in a murder trial.
You should have some questions.
We need to at least ask these people,
Do you know this guy?
I mean, not that know you, but, you know, there's developing, in my opinion, in all the cases that I've tried, there's developing more of a core set of questions. You know, have you ever been the victim of,
yes,
or prosecuted for, or arrested for, or
family member?
Even if you've been the victim of a burglary and no one got arrested, I want you to come tell me.
So,
you know, if we're in a burglary case. And so I try to err on the side of asking all those questions. Now, some of those questions have been specifically excluded by the Supreme Court, and I don't think the attorneys have read those cases. But, you know, I try to err on the side of, and if, you know, if I get a bunch of people responding, I let them come up front and to where they don't have to answer in front of the entire group. I let the attorneys come up there, and then we take it in that kind of private setting. Now, I tried one of the high profile cases I tried 3 or 4 years ago that was all over the news.
The bakery one?
No, it was, remember the college student who got shot by the stray bullet. Martha's, I can't remember her last name, but that case had so much media. that I did the majority of voir dire in the jury room with the jurors individually because it had so much media. Now, the attorneys were allowed to be there,
of course,
and it was on the record, but I pulled every single one of those people in the room.
So they could feel comfortable
and
be candid in their
responses. That's right. So they could be candid, and the attorneys and I got together on that case and created a whole series of extra questions that I was going to ask them during that time. And then at the end of each one, I would say to the attorneys, is there anything else you want me to ask juror X for both sides? You know? And so, you know, I think there's some things that we can do, but you know, I think the short answer is some kind of rule change. But now I've done attorney conducted voir dire because I've done a death penalty trial.
Mm. Right.
And it's and of course I did a death penalty trial as a lawyer. I tried Quattlebaum 2. When Quattlebaum got sent back from the Supreme Court, the Lexington County Solicitor's Office was recused from the case and the Fifth Circuit was appointed on the case and I worked there then. So I tried that case, which the only thing we made it through was jury qualifications. But I've watched attorney conducted voir dire and it is a whole nother another art form that the majority of the attorneys in this state do not know how to do. So.
Okay, we need to have war stories.
Yeah. And so for those listening with attorney conducted voir dire, I went to the National Criminal Defense College and that whole section, it is an art form. You need practice. You'll need to go to trainings.
Oh, 100%. To do it properly. I mean,
can't just wing it.
Now, no, right. In my death penalty, I had career prosecutors, and then the defendant that I tried for the death penalty, one of his attorneys was a circuit solicitor whose resume has tried multiple death penalty cases. So attorney conducted voir dire in that case
wasn't a problem.
Everybody knew what they were doing. And then, but we spent the first day with them figuring out how much I'm going to let them get away
right.
with.
How long the leash was.
So the first day, day's painful. And then day 2, 3, 4, 5, it all smooths out. And then everybody gets tired. And that makes it go a little bit faster, too. But
fatigue helps.
I've witnessed attorney conducted voir dire a bunch from all the death penalties that I've been involved in. And it's its own art form, unlike anything else.
Well, we could talk to you all day. Unfortunately, all good things must come to an end. We're at the portion where we call it war stories.
All right.
And so you get to choose a war story that's either, as just like to say, a poignant one, or it's one that's exciting or memorable to you. You know, anything that it can be from your days as a prosecutor, days in private practice, or now on the bench, we'll leave it wide open.
All right. So can I tell two if they're short?
I like that the judge is asking me. Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
So I'm going to tell funny ones because
that's what people want to hear.
Lighten it up early. You can definitely get two if they're funny.
All right. What we do is too serious not to be able to laugh. So there's a plaintiff's attorney in Columbia whose name is Barry George. And Barry George is a wonderful human being and he's a great lawyer. And the first case I ever tried with him was in Lexington County and it was a wreck case. And
what year is this?
2013, 2014. And so I come in on the bench and we're in Lexington, not in Richland. And I say to Barry George, and I don't remember who the defense attorney was, but they were not prepared for what they were getting themselves into. just the person of Barry George. So I said, Mr. George, how long do you think this case is going to take? And he said, and I quote, 3 hours if you do your job right. So we get started and his client's on the witness stand and she had been involved in a motor vehicle wreck. And he said, now, ma'am, how much was your car worth? And she said, $3,000. And he said, well, how do you know your car was worth $3,000? She said, well, I bought it the day before the wreck and the car was totaled. So Barry sat down. So the defense attorney, who again didn't know what he was in for, he had the bill of sale, right? And so he showed this woman the bill of sale, which was, he'd already shown it to me. It was clearly her bill of sale for this car. And he said, ma'am, is this the bill of sale? And she said, it could be. Ooh. And he said, well, is this your name on it? She goes, I guess. And he said,
oh, that's not getting in. He
said, is this your signature at the end of this? And she said, I don't know. And he said, well, ma'am, this bill of sale says that you paid $1,500 for the car the day before the wreck. And she said, yeah, but the rims were $1,500 too.
Full value.
Full value, right.
Full value of the car.
So my second one, a lot of judges in criminal guilty pleas ask the question of defendants, tell me what you did, right? Well, I don't ever ask that question for fear of what they might say, which is usually, I didn't do it.
Right.
As the defense attorney standing there, every time that question gets asked, I just hold breath.
Cringe, right.
Yeah, pause.
Put your hand over your client's mouth.
In my life, I've only asked that question one time. And so I'm holding court in Kershaw County. And as I'm walking into the building, the bailiff who comes out to meet you, who's a friend of mine, says, hey, Judge, we got a leprechaun today. And I said, and he jokes with me all the time. And I said, Mr. Geddes, I said, what did the leprechaun do? And he said, he stole a basketball goal and, you know, kind of made a joke about it. So I didn't think about it again. So I'm going on through court and lo and behold, the next case gets called. And the defendant comes up to the bar and he's can't see over the bar in Kershaw County. And he's got red hair and a beard, but no mustache. And so I look at his sentencing sheet and it says he's from Iowa or Idaho or somewhere like that. And he's pleading to a possession of a drug charge. And so about this time,
you looked at the bailiff, I'm sure.
Everybody in the courtroom is kind of laughing, right? I mean, they're all, you know, everybody's kind of giggling, and I'm doing my best to keep a bugger face. And I just...
The decorum.
Right. I just looked right at him, and I just said,
What did you do?
I said, tell me what you did.
Just let it roll.
And he said, I was with the circus in Myrtle Beach, where I'm a performer, and the circus left town. So I decided to stay in Myrtle Beach and make a little extra money with the ladies.
Oh, my God.
Now, we're in Camden, right? And I said, well, how did you get to Camden, South Carolina? And he said, so I caught the bus out of Myrtle Beach. And while on the bus, I consumed a bunch of ecstasy and got high on the bus. So when the bus stopped in Camden, I got kicked off the bus. And then there was this African-American police officer who was always in court. I think his last name was Burris. And he would come to court to kind of, you know, see what was going on and that kind of thing. And he said, you see that cop right there? The defendant said that. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, he found me naked by the river. And I looked over at Officer Burris, and he was shaking his head.
He was in agreement.
Yeah. And I said, well, sir, how long have you been at the Kershaw County Jail? And he said, 67 days. And I said, time, sir. You know, have a good day. And so the next morning, I come back to Kershaw County. I've kind of forgotten, you know, about the leprechaun at that point.
And his lucky charm.
Right. And the guy who runs the jail comes into chambers, and he says, Judge, I got to confess. And I said, what's wrong? And he goes, I got to confess. I violated one of your orders. And I said, well, what happened? He said, you remember the leprechaun? And I said, well, yeah, of course I remember the leprechaun. He said, well, he didn't have the bus doesn't leave till the next morning. And he had no money and nowhere to stay. So I let him spend the night at the jail and then drove him to the bus stop. Not for the podcast, but I have a picture of the leprechaun that I can show for the live audience.
See, it's something special for us that only we can enjoy.
The guest host, I came on the best week.
That's right. Thank you so much for being on the show. Obviously, we can't. There's no social media to plug for the judiciary. I don't believe
none for me.
Yeah, you'll stay away, and that's obviously probably the best advice for every listener.
Justice, you would disagree.
Well, so you know, when you're trying to educate people and do public service work, then I think you got an exception. But beyond that, generally, Facebook and social media ruins lives. What you see on a daily basis.
Yeah, true. No kidding.
Do you want to plug your social media? Do you want
I don't have any social media. I've never heard of it.
All right. That's a good thing. Well, again, thank you so much, Judge Hood, for coming on the show. Remember, you can follow us at SC Law Pod on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. You can follow Joseph at Joseph P. BS on Twitter, myself at SC Crim Lawyer, and Amber at Red Judicata. Again, like, share, follow, give us 5 stars, spread the word, tell your friends, families, dog, neighbor. Let everybody know that we have a podcast and that it's awesome. And please listen. And thank you again. And we'll see you next week.
Yes.